maybe it's probably a good time to start. Most people seem to have trickled in. So our next speaker is Sarah Komagrom. And I think just as a quick note for the rest of the conference, so we're gonna have the banquet starts at 5:30, so essentially after the talk, but I don't think it's a very sharp beginning, but we can just slowly migrate over there, and it's on the second floor where lunch is also served. So, all right.
Okay, thanks very much for the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. So I'll be discussing some work that has been completed essentially, well, more or less a year ago with Alexander Zhiboyedov, who is nowadays moving from Princeton to Harvard. And now there is also work in progress with Manuela Kulakhidze, Andrei Parnachev, and Alexander Zhiboyedov, which is very much related to the previous work, which has also the same title as the title of this talk. There is also a related work by Liam and Jared, who are in the audience, and David, the two Davids. So you can also talk to them about it. And I will be very happy if you ask questions during the talk. It would make it much more interactive and interesting for everybody. Okay, so this is a talk about conformal filters in dimensions above two. They're of course interesting for a variety of reasons. In this audience, I guess I don't need to motivate too much the study of conformal filters. They appear at second order phase transitions, so they're omnipresent in statistical mechanics, condensed matter physics, and so on. They also appear at the endpoints of renormalization group flows, which is of course related to the first point. And for high energy physics, they also secretly describe quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space. So there are tons of reasons to try to understand CFTs, starting from very theoretical or mathematical questions, and of course, culminating in practical questions that pertain to systems that can be prepared in the lab. So many conformal filters are quite well understood because they have a small parameter in which we can expand. And there is really there are several families of such theories. So just to mention a few, critical models, ON critical models, which are very familiar to statistical physics, people, condensed matter physicists, high energy physicists. So those have a large n parameter, and they're exactly solvable at infinite n. Then there is a family of theories which are Banach-Zaks-like, where you take some theory with many flavors, many colors, you send all the parameters to infinity, and there is a delicate fixed point that arises. Quantum electrodynamics with many charged fermions is very important in condensed matter physics, spin liquid theory. That's also a conformal field theory with sufficiently many fermions. Wilson-Fisher fixed points, and also theories with exactly marginal couplings. So sometimes conformal field theories are not isolated, but there is a whole family of conformal field theories that you can probe by deforming a given theory. And then you can study, sometimes there is a weak coupling parameter along this conformal manifold. And those also can be studied perturbatively. But actually, some of the most interesting conformal filters do not have any small expansion parameter, and they're most interesting both from the point of view of experiment and also from the point of view of theory. So many second order phase transition points, such as the three-dimensional Ising model, which is also, I mean, the same universality class as boiling water at the second order phase transition point. So boiling water doesn't have a small parameter. QED3, three-dimensional quantum electrodynamics with a small number of fermions, is an extremely interesting theory for spin liquid and for various other reasons. And it does not have a small, it does not have a good description when the number of fermions is small. Also, many theories that appear naturally in high energy physics, such as the four-dimensional supersymmetric CFTs, CFTs with higher than CFTs in higher than four dimensions, theories that appear in the context of ADS CFT, most of them would not have a manifest small expansion parameter. So the question is, what can be said about such theories? Of course, this is an extremely hard question, but I'll try to say something semi-intelligent about that. So conformal filters in two dimensions are not something I'm going to talk about too much, basically because those have an infinite symmetry group and are sometimes solvable. So if minimal models are famously solvable, rational conformal filters and so on. But I just wanted to note that in higher dimensions, so higher dimensions means d bigger than 2, there is not a single example for a conformal filter that is not free, where the energy momentum tensor two-point function is finite, which has been exactly solved. this additional provision that the two-point function is finite is just to eliminate these models which exist at infinite n, which can be exactly solved. So if you require the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor to be finite, there is not a single non-trivial exact solution for the constraints of conformal field theory. So we don't have, in some sense, a good example to study. So CFTs are completely well-defined mathematically in the following sense. So in some, they can, the problem of understanding conformal field theories can be completely spelled out mathematically. So there are these bootstrap equations, which essentially say that the expansion in partial waves in one channel is equal to the expansion in partial waves in another channel. So the expansion in partial waves in each channel describes some four-point function completely. And if there are two ways to describe a given four-point function, then the two descriptions must agree. And this is also sometimes referred to as the constraint of associativity of the operator algebra. These constraints are believed to be extremely strong. Lots of experience with these constraints, and especially recent development of studying these constraints numerically, strongly suggests that the solutions to these constraints are practically in one-to-one correspondence with physical conformal field theories. So the idea is to try to find all the possible solutions to the constraint that the operator algebra is associative. Of course, mathematicians study such problems quite often, for example, in the context of ring theory. But this problem seems to be far more complicated, because there are infinitely many operators, infinitely many partial waves, and the analytic form of these partial waves is not very pleasant either. It's very complicated. It involves very complicated functions. But this is completely mathematically well-defined because the two expansions, although they're infinite, they have overlapping regions of convergence. So you can pick some points in the space of correlators where both expansions converge. So solving it might be a formidable task, but posing it seems to be fine.
Is it useful to go beyond the four-point function, or all the information is already contained there?
It's believed that in two dimensions, we know that the information is contained in that. It's believed to be the case in general, that the if you impose that for all possible external states, all the possible products are associative, that should be exhaustive. I should say, though, that this is just somehow addressing a subset of what there is in conformal field theory, just the space of local operators and their correlation functions. Conformal field theories may have additional information, for example, topological sectors, right? And those are not captured by such constraints. For those, you may need to go to curved space and impose various consistency conditions on topological field theories. But that's just a completely separate problem.
About things like finite temperature correlation functions, or things like cylinders or toruses.
Exactly.
Are those determined by these equations or no?
No. Even, every time you put, you have a circle, once you have a circle, additional topological degrees of freedom can matter. And the partition function on S2 times S1. The partition function on a sphere times S1 would be fine. It's completely determined by the space of local operators because there is a conformal mapping between the cylinder, the generalized cylinder, and flat space. So that would be fine. But the other curved spaces may be affected by topological degrees of freedom. So this classification problem is just about the space of local operators and their correlation functions. So this is a very complicated set of equations, and they don't have a manifest expansion parameter in general. Of course, when there is large n or a manifest expansion parameter, we can use that, but otherwise it doesn't have. So the main point of this talk is that I want to advocate an idea. And the idea is that there is, in fact, an expansion parameter, and it's the angular resolution, or the inverse spin. And you'll see that this idea is not just a vague suggestion. If you take this idea seriously, you can arrive at exact analytic results for any conformal field theory above two dimensions, which can be tested in the laboratory and also in numeric simulations. So this is the main idea, that somehow spin can be used as an expansion parameter. And there is a sensible effective theory that you can sort of organize in this expansion in 1/spin.
So there's a known expansion in terms of twists in QCD. Is this related?
No, completely not. Well, no. I don't want to say not completely, because somehow, Lorentzian OP expansions in twists play a role in proving some of the theorems that I'm going to quote. But you are talking about the OP expansion on the light cone. Yes. So if you are in Euclidean space and you just separate two operators, the operator product expansion is governed by the dimension. In Lorentzian space, if you separate them across a light-like ray, then the expansion is governed by the twist of the operator rather than the dimension. That's a very interesting kinematical observation, which is useful for Lorentzian OPs and so on, but it has nothing to do with that, essentially. This is a statement in Euclidean space, in a sense. And also twist, the notion of twist will play an important role. So you'll see. Okay, so in a sense that I'll try to make precise, there is a completely well-defined perturbation theory in one over spins in any conformal field theory. And one can obtain a variety of exact results about any conformal field theory. And I'll try to contrast the results that we'll get from this approach with experimentally accessible results and also numeric methods and also IDSCFT. So that would be what I'll try to do. Okay, so since I'm going to describe some expansion in one over the spin, I have to explain what am I expanding around? What is my harmonic oscillator? And so I'll describe now a solution to the bootstrap equations. So there is a solution to these bootstrap equations, which is unphysical. So it does not seem like a good starting point for an expansion. But you'll see that it is, in fact. So this solution to the bootstrap equations is something that people call generalized free fields. And this is a completely fine solution to the bootstrap equations, except that it suffers from some unphysical feature that I'll explain. So the idea is that you just declare that there is an operator phi, a local operator, and it has dimension delta. So its two-point function is fixed by scale invariance to be 1 over the separation to the power 2 delta. And then you just declare that all the endpoint functions are given by weak contractions. So if you want to calculate the four-point function, you just do the weak contractions. Or in some sense, that there are no connected diagrams. So everything is given in terms of disconnected diagrams, two-point functions. So we can determine very easily the four-point function, and it's dead. Once you have the four-point function, you can do the inverse partial wave decomposition and read out the spectrum of the theory, because the four-point function can be decomposed in the S channel or the T channel, and you can read out the spectrum of the theory. So by reading out the spectrum of the theory, one discovers that this is an unphysical model in the following sense. So you read out the spectrum of the theory, you find the unit operator. The unit operator is, so if we do the decomposition in the S channel, meaning that we decompose this product in partial waves, there is the unit operator, which is responsible for this term. Then there is the operator phi itself, which actually does not appear in the partial wave decomposition. And then there are bilinear operators, phi, S derivatives, and N, the Lambertian operators. And those are responsible for accounting for these other guys. So these terms come from the unit operator in the T channel and the U channel. But if you try and insist that you get them from partial wave in the S channel, then you need to introduce these bilinear operators. And this theory is called generalized free because the dimensions of these operators are the naive ones. So they are twice the dimension of phi plus S times for this derivative plus 2n times for the Lambertian operator. Now, this spectrum does not contain the energy momentum tensor unless delta is equal to precisely d over 2 minus 1. The case where delta is equal to d over 2 minus 1 is what's known as the Landau-Ginzburg theory, which is free field theory. So unless this is free field theory, and this is just, you know, like the ordinary four-point function of free field theory, the spectrum does not contain the energy momentum tensor. And this is disastrous because the energy momentum tensor is important for the locality of the theory. If we don't have an energy momentum tensor, we don't know how the theory responds to a small curvature in space, and the notion of locality is somehow endangered.
So,
no. So I'll make a small, this is a great question. I'll make a small detour. I'll answer it actually in words instead of using the blackboard. So the energy momentum tensor, when it acts on any operator, must spit out the operator on the right-hand side. So if you take the energy momentum tensor with any local operator, the OPE must contain this guy with some derivatives. And the reason is that the energy momentum tensor generates translations. Because the OP coefficients in conformal field theory are symmetric, that means that when you do any real operator with itself, it must contain the energy momentum tensor. So the fact that the energy momentum tensor is not in the spectrum is disastrous. It means that somehow you don't have locality in this theory. So this is not, yes?
The less sort of drastic way of saying this is essentially taking the infinite central charge, right? So the coefficient T is 1 over infinity.
Yeah, you could say that it's decoupled. There, yeah, so, but by itself, this theory is not satisfactory. So it's not a good solution to the bootstrap equations in the sense that it does not contain an energy momentum tensor, but otherwise, it's a perfectly good solution. Okay, that's what I've got to say about it. So this theory is not a very good model by itself, but it will serve as the starting point for some expansion that would be completely fine. So in this theory, we know exactly the spectrum of the operators. As I told you, they behave as if they're free. And we know exactly the OPE coefficients for all these bilinears. So there are some, you know, combinatorially complicated coefficients in fusing this bilinear operator with the product of two phis. They're just a product of gamma functions and some mess like that. And they're known exactly. It's just combinatorics. So we know everything about this theory, but it's not a satisfactory theory by itself. And I'll just use it as a starting point for some expansion that would be fine. Any questions? So let me start from the first assertion that is non-trivial. So define the twist of an operator to be the difference between the dimension and the spin. That's a useful quantity, which is called the twist, which was already brought up in the beginning of this talk. So the first theorem that I will not prove, but is proven in the papers, is that if the twists tau 1 and tau 2 are present in the spectrum, then we necessarily have operators whose twists are arbitrarily close to the sum. So the spectrum is very complicated if you think about it. Any two delta minus s's in the spectrum, then the sum must also be in the spectrum. Well, it doesn't have to be in the spectrum. There must be operators whose twist is arbitrarily close. So there would be infinitely many operators that would generically approach the sum tau 1 plus tau 2. That's an assertion about any conformal field theory above two dimensions. This is not true for theories in two dimensions. Indeed, if you take the Ising model, the two-dimensional Ising model, there is an operator with dimension 1 over 8 in some convention. 3 over 8 is not in the spectrum. Okay, but in higher dimensions, we claim that there would always be operators whose twists are arbitrarily close to tau 1 plus tau 2. The proof assumes unitarity and that the number of dimensions is bigger than 2. I will not outline the proof, just as a sketch, that means that the spectrum of higher dimensional CFTs is quite complicated. So for every two operators with twists tau 1 and tau 2, if you are not comfortable thinking about twists, think about dimension, dimension minus spin. So for any two operators, tau 1 and tau 2, there would be infinitely many operators generically that approach the asymptote tau 1 plus tau 2. But then for any other guy here, you must also form the sum with tau 1. And so the spectrum forms this complicated space with many, many points where things condense. So this is just a sketch of the spectrum. And generically, there would be infinitely many operators that approach the asymptote from below or from above. We don't yet know.
But also it can be a single operator with this dimension.
Yes, that can happen in principle. That can happen in principle, mm-hmm. Yes. But you'll see that from what I said so far, that can happen in principle. But I'll prove some stronger results soon that will rule it out. Okay. So you would see, there would always be infinitely many operators that approach this point, as far as I can say. Okay. So this is very, very different from two dimensions. It's much more complicated. What I will discuss is how so. We can describe what's going on when this asymptote is approached. This is the large spin expansion that I talked about. You see that this axis is log of s. So when you increase the spin, some operators get closer and closer to this asymptote. And there would be a systematic expansion around this asymptote, which would lead to lots of exact results, which can be tested. And they would not be confined to just large spin. Some of them can be extended to exact results about the whole sequence. Okay, so that's the idea. So let me just make more precise statements. So we consider the OP of two operators, O1 and O2. You can think about them as scalar operators. So the twist coincides with dimension. And then there is a complicated OP expansion where we expand in spin and various flavor indices or various other indices that count operators. So the claim is that for large enough spin, so for operators in the OP expansion with large enough spin, there would always be operators which have twist arbitrarily close to tau 1 plus tau 2. Physically, that means that at large spin, forming these bilinears by multiplying two operators and sticking, sorry, this phi should have been O. So that means that in any conformal field theory, forming these bilinears O, DS, O for large enough S makes sense. Okay, in general, it does not make any sense. Definitely doesn't make sense in two dimensions. But for any conformal field theory above two dimensions, for large enough spin, these operators make sense, and they behave as if they're free. So their twist is very, very close to being the sum of the twist phi of the two phi's, of the two O's, sorry. Notice that the derivative does not change the twist because its dimension is one and its spin is one. So the twist of these operators is just the sum of the twist of this guy and the sign and the twist of this guy.
You, is S there and F is a different thing?
Yeah, so the precise claim, sorry that it's not completely clear from the slide. The precise claim is that in this OP, there would appear operators which you can think about in this way, infinitely many of them.
But the and symbol S here and the symbol S there mean completely different things.
This and this?
Yes.
No, this is the spin.
It is the spin. Okay, you said that you just said that operator doesn't change the spin.
I said that the derivative
dimension,
the derivative adds to the operator naively the dimension one unit of dimension, but also one unit of spin.
Oh, different.
So it does not change the twist.
Twist.
It does not change the twist, but it does change the spin. Okay. So
there's actually some, you're saying there's some large n expansion where n counts actually the spin.
Yes.
So that's
yes.
Where you're going.
Yeah. I'm saying that there is a small expansion parameter in any CFT, which is this spin, and you'll see what you can derive from that. Okay, so it's not only that the dimensions of these operators behave as if they're free, also their OP coefficients asymptotically approach the combinatorial OP coefficients of generalized free field theory. So it's really like asymptotic freedom at small angles in some sense. But when you go to small angles, you have asymptotic freedom. Now, there is this integer n, little n, which I omitted, this number of boxes. And you can think about those as daughter trajectories. So there are these operators whose twist is tau 1 plus tau 2. And an insertion of a box changes the twist by 2n, by 2 units. One box changes the twist by 2 units. So you can think about daughter trajectories in the language of QCD, if you want. And those also behave as free fields and so on. You can even consider more interesting limit where the number of boxes and the number of derivatives both go to infinity, and you may or may not expect that the theory becomes free in this limit as well. This is no longer clearly a small angle limit. It's a more complicated limit, but there is lots of evidence in the literature that this limit should also lead to some simplification. I would not discuss that. I will just discuss the large spin limit with little n equals to zero for simplicity. But there might be there may be a more general story. So I'll actually not try to outline the proofs of these results. I'll just show you the applications because those are more interesting. And also I wanted to note that this theorem that twist becomes additive at large spin, that the theory essentially becomes free, is reminiscent of some calculations that Cullen and Gross have done many years ago in weakly coupled models in four dimensions consisting of fermions and bosons. So they saw that some operators get only weakly renormalized. Yes. Yes. What means that the renormalization does not have a positive power of the spin. So when you go to very large spin, somehow the coupling becomes even weaker than weak. It's suppressed by the spin. This was observed in some models of fermions and fermions and scalars in four dimensions without gauge fields and so on. So it was it was a very nice work, but I think these results generalize it very, very much. Okay, so the first thing, so what I would like to discuss is the asymptotics when we approach this small angle limit, so the large spin limit. So how does this function approach the asymptote? So we'll study the dependence of the twist as a function of the spin minus the twist of the initial two operators. And that's a very small number, if you believe these pictures. and you should be able to write a formula for it, if there is indeed a free limit. And this is analogous to doing a one-loop computation in quantum chromodynamics or any other Yukawa model or whatever you like. The computation is really technically somewhat similar. So the first thing that you find is that when you go to very large spin, this difference is indeed suppressed by some positive power of the spin. So we approach the asymptotes smoothly and nicely with some coefficient C and some power of the spin. The power of the spin is completely determined by the first non-trivial operator in the theory. By that I mean the operator with the smallest twist aside from the unit operator. So in many models, that would be the energy momentum tensor or the stress tensor. So you can substitute mentally instead of tau star d minus 2. And you see why many of these results are actually quite subtle in two dimensions, because then the asymptote doesn't really exist and it's more complicated. But above two dimensions, tau star, namely the smallest twist of the operator aside of the first operator aside from the unit operator, is always positive. So we always have nice smooth approach to the asymptote tau 1 plus tau 2. That was also observed by computations in ADS-CFT and was emphasized by Aldai Maldacena, that this is the behavior that you find. We can actually compute the coefficient C exactly. So this is a non-perturbative formula that just comes from solving the bootstrap equations. If you believe that the bootstrap equation simplifies large spin, then you should be able to use them to determine this coefficient. And indeed, it can be done. We get a closed-form formula for this coefficient C in any conformal filtering. And it depends just on one number, which is the two-point function of the stress tensor. This number is actually fixed by anomaly in four dimensions. In three dimensions, it was measured in many interesting phase transitions. So we can compute C exactly in many, many interesting models. Now, notice that this coefficient is positive. So the spectrum is always convex at very large spin. So this picture is ruled out. The spectrum is always convex. It's asymptotically convex.
So, 0.01 not equal to
say again?
You assume here 0.01 is equal to 0.02.
Yes.
If
yes.
0.01 is not equal to 0.02, it's still convex?
No. No, no, it's not. Yeah, here it's assumed that the two operators are the same, and then the spectrum is convex.
But on your graph, L1 and L2 should be...
Yeah, yeah, so this result that says that the spectrum is always convex is only true when L1 is equal to L2 star. If it's not the case, then it's not true. So when I said ruled out, I meant for the case that the two operators are essentially the same or the complex conjugate of each other. So there is actually a much stronger result that you can prove, which is that it's not only asymptotically convex, it's exactly convex. So even that is ruled out. You see the little bump that I tried to, so this is ruled out. It must be exactly convex, starting from some finite small spin. That you can also prove. Determining this finite small spin from which it's exactly convex is quite hard. I don't know how to do that. You can prove that there is such a finite number, but it's hard to determine what's the number. And from studying many, many examples, we've come to the conclusion that this number is always 2. This is just an empirical observation. And from now on, I'll assume that this is indeed the case, that this finite number from which convexity kicks in is 2. This is consistent with all the known examples as far as we can say. We don't know how to prove that. So let me show you the first one application of this exact computations at large spin in any conformal field theory. So one of the first computations people did with ADS-CFT was to take this n equals 4 QFT at strong coupling and to try to compute the anomalous dimension of the Lagrangian operator inserting S derivatives and another Lagrangian operator. So that's exactly an operator of the kind that I was talking about, right? And well, for the formalism that you need to do this computation is to do some Witten diagrams in ADS-5. And that's a very technically involved computation that people have done in the early days of ADS-CFT. And this is what they got. So there is a funny 96 over n squared, where n is the number of flavors, where n is the rank of the gauge group of this theory. And there is 1 over spin squared suppression. The 1 over spin squared suppression should not surprise you. That's exactly d minus 2. So that's the first result that I mentioned. So we can test that because we have an exact formula for this coefficient that we've derived in NECFT. And if you plug the correct two-point function in n equals 4, which is fixed by an anomaly, so it doesn't require any input from ADS-CFT, you plug this number C, then you plug delta equals 4, which is the dimension of the Lagrangian operator, you get exactly the same result. So you can reproduce a complicated computation in ADS-5 at strong coupling using these methods. So that's a nice consistency check. Then you can go to the Isaac model. In the Isaac model, so the Isaac model CFT is a Z2 symmetric conformal field theory, where lots of data is known experimentally and from numeric simulations. So the lowest lying operator has this dimension 0.518. Then there is the energy operator, which has 1.40, whose dimension is 1.41. And let's consider the OP of two spin fields, so sigma x, sigma 0. So from our results about convexity and the fact that the asymptote is tau 1 plus tau 2, you can immediately infer the dimension of the spin field with s derivatives inserted in the middle times another factor of the spin field at large spin. So this is the formula at large spin. That's a prediction for the Isaac model. But actually, from the fact that the spectrum is exactly convex, you can say something much stronger. You can predict that the spin 4 operator will have twists smaller than 1.037, but it has to be bigger than 1 from unitarity. So you can nail down the twist of the spin 4 operator very severely. It should be between 1.03 and 1.0. And indeed, it comes out at 1.02 from numeric studies of the Ising model. You can then predict something much more dramatic, that in the Ising model, there must be operators in the tiny sliver between 1.02 and 1.037 for any spin. So we know that at spin 2, the twist is 1. Then we have another data point, 1.02, from experiment or numerics. And we know that the asymptote is 1.03. So the whole thing has to sit in this tiny sliver between 1.02 and 1.03. So that's a very, that's a prediction about the Ising model that would or would not be verified in the future. Yes, so you could say that the spins are very, very small, the twists are very small, which is suggestive of a softly broken higher spin symmetry. But yeah, but these bounds are analytic. You just, you use some data points from experiment or numerics, and the fact that everything else has to sit here is an analytic consequence of our results. And we know exactly how this line of points would approach the asymptote that is controlled by this asymptotic formula. So we have lots of data. So as I said, we can prove. So convexity, it's easy to prove that there is asymptotic convexity. That's a straightforward computation. It's harder to prove that there is exact convexity starting from some finite spin. But this can be done.
Aren't those two the same statement? If you are asymptotically convex, there must be a number after which you are convex.
No, but I'm saying that the number is universal. Doesn't depend on the model.
Does not depend on CFT, you're
saying? This number would not depend on some. Let me think how to phrase it in the most precise fashion that I can. Asymptotic convexity conservative way to say that is that asymptotic convexity that just implies that this coefficient is positive. Okay, that by itself does not mean that there is a finite number after which it would be convex. You need to assume various things about convergence of the asymptotic expansion and stuff like that. So it's a pedantic distinction.
Sorry, is convexity in S or log S? Or doesn't change?
It's exactly convex from starting from spin equals 2. So the picture is just this. It doesn't matter in which variable you would plot it. It would look like that.
From a log is a convex function, no? So it doesn't matter whether you put in log S or S. That's what he's asking.
Yes. So what what you can prove is that it's convex in S.
In S.
Yeah.
So in particular, it's a monotonic function?
Yeah, in particular, it's a monotonic function. And that can also be proven, that it can be proven that it's monotonic starting from some finite spin. That's a relatively easy result to prove. OK, so the Ising model, so one has this prediction. One can also contrast the results with Wilson-Fisher fixed points. So there is lots of data about the epsilon exponent. Yes?
Sir, but you have no idea what the dimensions of those operators are. Like, they could be ridiculous to have dimensions.
No, but we know that their twist is, you know, like between 1.02 and 1.03.
But you're using numerical results in the Ising model for that.
No, even if I did not use any numerical, even if I did not use any numerical result, I'm using one result, which is that the dimension of the spin field is 0.5.
That's what I like.
Yeah, that's the one result that we need to use. But from that, you can infer the dimensions. Yeah. Okay. There is a similar story for the epsilon expansion. There are, you know, like complicated. There are straightforward one-loop diagrams that Wilson and Fisher computed. Wilson Kogut computed. And you can reproduce the results using our methods without any one-loop computation, just using the bootstrap equations. You can like nail down these coefficients using this formula that I showed you. Okay. Also, I wanted to mention that recently there has been a spur of activity in analyzing conformal filters by some systematic numeric approach, and there is lots of data about the Ising model and similar phase transitions. And as far as I can say, all the available data is consistent with this picture that I've advocated. Okay, are there any questions about this part of the talk? Okay, now I want to discuss the OPE coefficients. So far I've concentrated on the idea that at large spin there is a new expansion parameter, and I've done what is reminiscent of the one-loop calculation around the Gaussian fixed point in quantum chromodynamics or something of this sort. Yeah.
Can you give an example of some physical thing where these large spin or large dimension operators are important?
So this prediction, for example, can be verified with existing technology quite easily. But you're asking important in.
I'm just thinking that I should only care about the lowest dimension operators.
No, but OK, so this is where this question that I got in the beginning comes in. The operators with the smallest twist are the leading contributions to the OPE in Lorentzian space around the light cone. And that's extremely important in QCD processes at high energies. Like light cone OPE is one of the leading tools for computing corrections to logarithmic running and stuff like that. Wilson loops, which are stretched along the light cone. All those things are dominated by the smallest twist operators.
QCD,
yeah.
Deep inelastic scattering.
But you sum
an infinite. You have an infinite sum. Right? The PDF is an infinite sum of.
Yes, I'm just saying that the expansion in twist. So it's true that operators with small dimension matter in Euclidean space. In Lorentzian space, operators with small twist are on the same footing. So if you do an expansion around the light cone, for you think there is a fast moving particle. And you try to do some expansion around the light cone for some endpoint function, you would encounter an expansion in twists. In deep inelastic scattering, that's the main tool that is being used.
QCD is not a CFT, except in the sense.
Yeah, that's true. But they add, so it's a free CFT. So in some regime, you can think about it as using the free CFT in the UV.
Is there an example of another CFT where I can imagine doing this kind of
stuff? So in N equals 4, there has been tons of,
physics.
You mean in three dimensions? You're asking if in condensed matter physics there is an application for Lorentzian OP. I wouldn't be shocked if the answer were yes, but because there is an effective light cone that happens at second order phase transition points. And I wouldn't be shocked if there were observables that are not dissimilar from deep inelastic scattering. So I don't see a reason why not. But maybe somebody in the audience could.
I mean, if you want a more highfalutin reason why this is interesting, you can view it as a proof of the cluster decomposition principle and a derivation of long-range gravity in ADX.
Yeah, that's also true. So the fact that at large spin, things become free is extremely closely related to the fact that if you separated particles in ADS, they would behave as if they don't see each other. So large spin means large separation. So
suppose you had a CFD3 and they had that, you can operate as a threshold at omega equals k.
Yeah.
In the spectral density. Now you want to figure out how that threshold is rounded by your relevant operators.
I think in second order phase transitions, which you know much more than me about, one could easily think of questions which would be for which the Lorentzian OP would be important, but I'm not an expert on the subject. My motivation for studying this problem has been to try to understand if the bootstrap equations, which look very hard at first sight, have an expansion parameter and whether you can use it for something. A hidden expansion parameter. Okay, so let me discuss the OP coefficients. So far I've been discussing the operators, and their dimensions and their twists and convexity. I just wanted to mention in passing that also the OP coefficients, since the model becomes free at small angular resolutions, also the OP coefficients of the appropriate operators just tend smoothly to their combinatorial generalized free field values. And there is a formula that is completely analogous to this formula, which describes how these OP coefficients asymptote to their combinatorial generalized free values. We can determine the coefficient exactly. We can determine the power exactly. It can be compared to tons of calculations in Wilson-Fisher fixed points in ADS-CFT, and also in maybe to some data in the Isaac model in the future. But let me just make some comments about what can we say about the OP coefficients of operators that are low-lying. So I'm now going to actually change the theme slightly. I'm not going to discuss large spin perturbation theory. I just wanted to make some comments of what can we say about these OP coefficients from first principles. Not large spin. So what I would like to discuss is a Gedanken experiment in which one does the following. So consider the operator O, and we are interested in doing the OP of O with its complex conjugate, and we want to learn something about these OP coefficients. So it's convenient to switch to Minkowski space, because then what I'm going to say would make sense. So what we do is we couple this operator to some source, J, and we think of this source as a weakly coupled particle. So we have a new term in the Lagrangian JO, and you can imagine adding a kinetic term for J, and it will be very, very weakly coupled to the CFT. And then what I'm going to do is to scatter this weakly coupled particle J off some state in the CFT. If you don't like to think about Hilbert spaces in CFTs, you can think that the CFT is deformed to some gapped phase, and you form some bound states, and then you scatter a virtual quanta of J off the state. This is called deep inelastic scattering in QCD. Just replace the virtual photon by a virtual J particle. So there is some state. This is some CFT matter. And we scatter a virtual particle J off this mess. And this just breaks down to many other particles or states. OK, so this is a deep inelastic experiment. And one thing we know about it is that the cross-section for this process is positive. And that's going to be the main theme, that using this positivity, one can derive highly non-trivial constraints on these OP coefficients. Okay, so the way it's done is that using the optical theorem, you can relate the cross-section for this Gedanken deep inelastic scattering to some two-point function in a non-trivial state H. We take the momentum Q squared of this virtual particle. So the momentum Q is the momentum of this virtual particle. We take it to be space-like so that it doesn't create particles by itself. It just scatters and goes away. So the physical deep inelastic scattering can take place as long as this invariant is bigger than one. But the OP expansion is valid only when this invariant is much, much bigger than everything else. So as usual, the OP expansion is valid in one regime. And the physical scattering can happens in another regime. But they can be related by the usual Cauchy theorem. So this is the regime where you have physical scattering. This is the regime where the OP expansion is valid near the origin. And so integrals over the deep inelastic cross-section, so positive moments of the deep inelastic scattering cross-section can be related to OP coefficients by a contour trick. This contour trick assumes good behavior at infinity, which I don't know how to establish mathematically. And the best I can say is that there would be a finite point from which this is true, a finite spin or a finite dimension from which what I'm saying is true. And experience shows that this is, again, spin equals 2. So there is a small loophole here. But if you swallow that loophole and just proceed, you can relate moments of the deep inelastic scattering to OP coefficients. Actually, this loophole exists in most of the literature on deep inelastic scattering. I'm just emphasizing it for completeness. So there is some physical process where you scatter a virtual particle, and that happens here. And then there is the OP regime, which is distinct. So let me show you an application. Let's suppose that we want to study the OP of two stress tensors. So there is the unit operator, and then there is the stress tensor as a partial wave with some prefactor. And this prefactor is known. It depends on three coefficients, A, B, and C, in four dimensions. It depends on three coefficients, A, B, and C. There is a parallel story in three dimensions. It works in a similar way. And A and C are related to some trace anomalies, and B is just a coefficient in the partial wave expansion. And so now we are doing graviton deep inelastic scattering, virtual gravitons. So we form some state in the CFT, and we imagine a Gedanken experiment where we scatter virtual gravitons of the state. And then we impose that the scattering cross section is positive. And that leads to highly non-trivial constraints on this OP coefficient and to this bound for the ratio between the trace anomalies. So A over C comes out to be smaller than 31 over 18, bigger than 3rd. You can check that this is true in highly non-trivial dynamical models where there is like Seiberg duality, QCD. This is always true in any known example. It also coincides with the result of Hoffman-Maldacena, who derived this bound in a completely different way. We don't know if this coincidence is part of a general story or it's just in this specific example. This is under investigation. But this idea of trying to put bounds on these OP coefficients by considering some Gedanken experiments akin to deep inelastic scattering seems to produce lots of bounds of this sort, and we're trying to understand how to systematize what we find.
So for higher spin operators, we need to scatter higher spin particles?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah. This is a weakly coupled particle. You just scatter it. It's a virtual particle. It's completely fine. I don't see an a priori problem with that.
Well, apart from the fact that it's not easy to construct theories.
Well, it doesn't matter, because what this virtual photon does is that it couples to the electromagnetic current. So what you really scatter off the proton is the electromagnetic current. And this thing is just a mnemonic for a two-point function of the electromagnetic current, which is completely well-defined. But this picture makes it manifest that you get a positive definite cross-section, because if you square this guy, you get something positive, and that's also the imaginary part of some two-point function.
Yeah,
but the problem is that I don't know, this does not rest on some axiomatic quantum field theory. So one can try to forget about the external particle and just phrase everything in terms of these two-point functions, but then I don't know what the cross-section would mean, so just to make it sound more palatable or more familiar, it's convenient to introduce a spurious particle that is weakly coupled and just couples to this current. But if you are willing to buy a version of the optical theorem that does not depend on the S-matrix, then you're in business.
Is there any reason why your bounds won't apply if you subtracted the Spurgeon relation, if you do one subtraction? In other words, if you differentiate...
Oh, yes.
Will it no longer apply if that's true?
That's completely true, yes. So what you say is true. The scattering cross section. So let me go back to this picture. Yeah. So this contour trick relies on the fact that very very far away there is sufficient decay, sufficient power law decay. If this is not the case, then all the dispersion relations would have to be subtracted. At least one of them would have to be subtracted. The first one. The other ones do not need to be subtracted, but the first one would need to be subtracted. And then you lose positivity, because this is positive. This is a positive moment of some cross-section. But the subtraction may or may not be positive. And then you don't know what to say about the OP coefficient.
Usually you can fix the subtraction by fixing some some parameter that they're.
Yeah, if you knew how the amplitude behaved in the Regi limit, then you would know how the subtraction looks like. But this is not something we know. So we don't know the sign of the subtraction. But if you assume that there is no subtraction, you get lots of bounds, all of which seem to be correct in all the known examples. And so we're just working under the assumption that somebody in the future could prove that in the Regi limit there is sufficient power law decay. That seems to be consistent with all the known examples, but we don't know how to prove that. It leads to a completely consistent picture that fits everything that's known. So this is what we're doing. Okay, so I'll just summarize. Conformal filters at higher dimensions have a secret expansion parameter, which is the spin. And the spectrum of twists becomes additive, which is similar to free field theory. So something, the energies or twists become additive. And I should say that this, of course, suggests that there is an effective field theory for twist, that, you know, in some very large, for very large spin, in this effective field theory, the states become free. So the energies become additive. There is a systematic non-perturbative computation of various corrections to anomalous dimensions, OPE coefficients, and so on. There is a convex spectrum of operators. And it leads to various predictions for strongly coupled models that can be compared against numerics, experiment, and ADS-CFT. And there are also ideas in progress about bounds on OPE coefficients whose scope we do not yet completely understand, but some of the simple examples seem to work very nicely. So that's all.
What will you need to now systematically compute corrections?
So there is a systematic procedure to compute corrections. You have a free field limit, and in principle, you could go on. I'll tell you what I think you need. So if you look at this formula, you see that it depends. So you needed to know the dimension of the lowest lying operator with the small twist low lying operator. And you needed to know something about its two-point function. That's the data that comes in for this large spin expansion. I think it's fair to say that the expansion would work in a similar way also at higher orders. So you would need more data from the low-lying operators to say something about the operators with large spin. So the next term in the expansion might involve the three-point function of the energy momentum tensor, or involve the twist of the operator that is next to the energy, after the energy, the next to next leading operator in twist after the energy momentum tensor.
Is it doable in practice, or it becomes too complicated?
No, it's completely doable. I mean, if you are willing to parameterize the answer in terms of some low-lying data, like three-point functions of low-lying operators, dimensions of low-lying operators, then you can write, I think, easily the two-loop answer in quotation marks, through, and so on. It's not too much. I don't believe it's too much work.
So when you write tau of s, you assume that there is an analytic function tau of s, which is a curve. But can't it be just some huge mass? Why does it need to be a curve tau of s and not something very messy?
It's a self-consistent approach. It's easy to prove that there are infinitely many operators whose twist is close to tau 1 plus tau 2 that you can prove rigorously. Then you just assume that there is such a function. You compute, you get a nice result. And then you can further show that, in fact, there is a family of operators that is exactly convex, starting from some spin. So that leads you to the picture that is behind these diagrams.
Some diagrams, but maybe I'm confusing things, where you have, say, the spin, and then the dimension, and then some band that starts growing, and there is an upper. And there is a band of points that becomes dense, and there is an upper limit, a lower limit, but in the middle, I would not associate curves to it. I would associate a continuum.
Yeah, this picture.
Why are they separated like that? Why aren't they dense?
Yeah, I mean, in practice, of course, it would be, you see that, I mean, once you start forming all the possible sums.
Then if it is dense, do you have a meaning for the curves in the middle of the dense domain, or just for the bottom and top?
I think that the most controllable domain or the set of operators is the one with the smallest twist.
Right,
okay. Then there is like then we can really prove rigorously that there is a set of operators that approaches this curve
from below. Okay, so this
is
like
below.
The lowing curve that I was mentioning.
So this is
the one and the two are the lowest operators.
Yeah, that one is the most controllable.
And if they are equal,
desensitizing
model.
If
there are some, if O1 and O2 are not the equal and not the smallest, then does it still make sense to speak of a curve? Because then if you're in the middle of a continuum.
Yeah, then I would still say that the that at large spin, there is a set of a subset of the operators that you encounter can be thought of as the product of one, the other, and S derivatives. So their OP coefficients would go to the generalized free field values. Their dimensions would go to the generalized free field values. So the family of operators that I'm talking about would still exist. But there may be lots of other operators around. Okay? And that family of operators would still be convex if it's O Dagger, if it's of the type O Dagger. In the Ising model, in this application for the Ising model, this is the lowest line twist. So this is extremely rigorous. There is no question of what that means. But once you have like a dense spectrum, then of course, this kind of questions could be relevant. Yes.
So in
the HTML,
presently the skewer Q with a lot of derivative in between has the dimension that goes.
That's right. This is, okay, this is a great question again. What I have been talking about here is the OP of an operator with itself, where I assumed, sorry, I'll just go to the relevant.
Can you repeat the question? What did you say?
The question is the following. Should I repeat it or you should? In n equals 4, it's known that if you form a quark bilinear and you put, S derivatives, sorry, this would be covariant derivatives. And you put S covariant derivatives in the middle. So there is lots of literature about computing the dimensions of those guys. They have to do with some flux tube that forms. And it actually goes like log of S, the dimension of these guys. So this seems to contradict what I said, because I said that the dimension should go to twice the dimension plus the spin. So my proposal would be twice the dimension of Q plus the spin. So that seems to be in contradiction. I would predict linear. There is no contradiction, however, because what I was talking about is the case where these operators O and O Dagger are gauge invariant. Sorry, those are not O's. Let me find the most appropriate slide. So, okay. I was talking about the case where these operators O or phi are gauge invariant. This is an extremely big difference because the flux tube doesn't form, and then everything I said is correct. It was crucial in many, many places in the proof and the technical statements that I did not prove that O is gauge invariant. So I'm talking about operators that appear in the OP of one gauge invariant operator and another gauge invariant operator. And then you have this asymptotic freedom in spin. This is not the case here because Q is not gauge invariant. So there is no flux tube. The log S comes from a flux tube. So, I just wanted to correct what I said. This is tau. The dimension anyway has a piece that's linear in spin, but the twist goes like log S, while I would have predicted that the twist goes like 1 over S squared. So there is a contradiction. But there is no contradiction, in fact, because Q is not gauge invariant. Yeah. Yeah.
You put up the dimension of the spin 4 operator in the Ising model.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
It looks like the difference from tau 1 plus tau 2 is actually, and this is consistent with everything you've proven, but it looks like it's actually quite a bit bigger than the asymptotic value you get, right? The formula is like some, actually on the previous, or maybe the next slide.
Yes.
It's a lot bigger than, right, it's a lot bigger than 0.0.
Yeah, you're saying that this expansion, this large spin expansion does not hit the spin 4 guy on the nose.
Is there anything?
Yeah, I think this has a simple explanation. This has a simple explanation, I think. You see, what's important in this formula, I'll tell you also how this can be made more effective. This expansion may be, like there is a renormalization group resummation of this expansion that I can suggest, which I think would make it much better. So you see that what enters here is the twist of the first operator after the unit operator, as you very well know. In the Ising model, if you just look at the results from this point of view, there are tons of operators with very small twists. So this is true at spins which are much, much larger than the exponent of some large number that has to do with the twist of the next to lowest lying operator. So this expansion is actually only true for very large, useful for any very large spin. But there are tons of operators with a small twist, and what you would like to do is to resum them all. And that can be done, I think, completely systematically, because these operators sit in approximate representations of higher spin symmetry. So if you look at higher spin symmetry conformal blocks, you could presumably resum this expansion and get a much better fit for low spin operators. That's what I would guess.
And so it sounds like you've looked at this. So do you know if that gets you significantly closer to the
I don't know. I don't know the numbers. Yeah. In the ON model, this would become much more extreme because there are infinitely many conserved currents. So they would all contribute on the same footing, right? In this formula, they would all be on the same footing. You need to resum them all, and there you can do it rigorously using higher spin symmetry.
Any further questions? No? Okay. Thanks so hard.